We've noted that Daniel was brought from the government of Babylon right into the government of Medo-Persia when the transition happened on the night of Belshazzar's feast. Daniel was set up as one of the top three under the king in Darius' government. And then Darius looked at him and felt that he was so trustworthy, he thought about making him number one over the governors and the satraps so that Daniel would be prime minister, second to the king. Now, we know that the other governors and satraps and politicians of the day were not too happy about being bypassed in their quest for power by this upstart Jew. Now, I say upstart. He was an old man. He's in his upper 80s. Has to be by now. And yet, he's not from Medo-Persia. He's from the old kingdom of Babylon. Why in the world should all of these other men who've worked their way up through the ranks into the power circles of the Medo-Persian Empire, now that it conquers the world, why should they step aside? Why some guy pulled over from Babylon, who's in his 80s, who's a Jew besides that, gets the upper position? So the Bible says that they began to look for a way, verse 4, to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. Based on the fact that Babylon was not destroyed, but simply was taken over, the archives hadn't been destroyed, the libraries weren't destroyed, the temples and palaces weren't destroyed. So all the records of 60 or 70 years of Daniel's service to Babylon, whatever records there were, they were there. And so they began to look through all of his records concerning the kingdom, and it says they could find no charge or fault against him because he was faithful. There was no error or fault found in him. Wouldn't it be nice to have somebody like that to vote for next Tuesday? I tell you. Anyway, so these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." Face it, God's way that he tells us to run our lives is different from the way the world runs itself. And we will always be, if we're true followers of Jesus, out of step with the direction the world's going. So they got to bring him down. This has nothing to do with fairness or rightness. This has to do with bringing him down by any way possible. Where two or three are gathered together, there will be politics. And power struggles. So it says they thronged before the king, buttered him up a little bit. "Oh, Darius, we hope you live forever. You're so wonderful." All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators, the satraps, the counselors, and the advisors, parentheses minus one, they forgot to mention that Daniel wasn't there, have consulted together and established a royal decree, make a firm decree, that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, will be cast into the den of lions. Now establish the decree, sign the writing, so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Now, again, as we talked about last week, that sounds a little far-fetched, but it's really no different than what you're going to be voting for on Tuesday. People saying, basically, if you'll look to us and vote us into office, we'll give you this, this, that, and the other thing. The whole idea is get the people to look to the government to supply its every need, and when the king, who's talked to and asked for things, no other gods or men, but only the king, and he supplies whatever the people desire, he will win, or should I say purchase, their loyalty. And of course, the world doesn't care how it gets power, just so it gets it, right? God won't purchase your loyalty. He asks for it. He reaches out to you in love, but he won't buy you. He won't bribe us. He offers us life. He offers us good things. But he says, "Come to me and I'll give you rest." The world says, "Oh, what do you want? Put me in power. I'll give you anything, 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 anything you want and become your enabler." So this really isn't so weird, except the lion's den thing's a little over the edge, isn't it? Nobody that's running for office today says, "If you don't vote me in, I'll throw you in the lion's den." Now, verse 10, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his window open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. This is what we looked at last week. He simply refused to alter his pattern of life based on his religious pattern of life based on the rules of secular authorities. That's just not their business. Now, the Bible doesn't say you have to pray with your window open. The Bible doesn't say you have to pray three times a day. The Bible doesn't say you have to face Jerusalem. That was a custom they had. But Daniel evidently decided he was not going to even appear to acquiesce to this command. He wasn't going to acquiesce. He was going to pray to his God anyway. So if he closes the doors and windows and hides out, he is looking like he has caved into their rules. He also knows they're out to get him and they'll find him one way or another. He knows they're going to bring him down if they can. And so he just goes on. It says, since early days. Remember back in chapter 1, verse 8, we said Daniel purposed in his heart as a young man that he would not defile himself. When he was a kid, hauled away as a slave to Babylon, he decided from that point on he would not cave in to the demands of others, even at the cost of his life, he would follow his God. And now, 70 years later, 68 years later, he is still in the same mode. He prays at the time of the morning sacrifice, which is no longer being offered in Jerusalem because it was ruins. He prays at the time of the evening sacrifice, the times of daily prayer, and he adds lunchtime in between. And he is a top government official, which means he's not exactly wandering around wondering what to do with his time. He obviously didn't pray when he found time to pray. He made time to pray and talk to God. The other thing we talked about last week was the fact that Daniel and the scriptures did not teach us ritual prayers. There are other groups that pray at specific times. Muslims pray five times a day. Various different groups have times of prayer, and they say, you say these words, get in this position, bow this way, do this thing, and it becomes just vain, what I think the Bible calls vain recitations. Matthew calls it vain repetitions, but I think it would be better translated vain recitations. As if when you say these words in this way, God somehow forgives your sins, he's appeased, he's happy, he's nice to you, gives you good things. The Bible does not present that kind of rote praying. Prayer is a conversation with God. Daniel spends time three times a day hanging out, talking, listening, communing with his God. This is not getting together or going aside three times and reciting things. Now, it says that the men assembled. Notice verse 11. The men assembled. Now, what does that mean? They got together. Where? They assembled and found Daniel what? Praying. They knew when he'd pray, where he'd be praying, and they just happened to all 122 of them show up in Daniel's yard. Well, fancy meeting you here. Oh, just taking a walk. Happened to be going down this street, you know. No, they come together in mass at Daniel's house right at prayer time. Well, look at that. Would you? Can you believe that? The guy's praying. He's breaking the law. You see? I mean, have you noticed how some politicians don't even hide their shenanigans? They just do it blatantly and get away with it? They show up, they assemble, they find him praying, and they go in mass to the king. And they spoke concerning the king's decree, verse 12, have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, will be cast into the den of lions? Now, you have to understand one thing I saw last week that I haven't seen in this text and all the times I've read it, verse 10. It says that Daniel knelt down on his knees three times that day. So the king signed the writing, it was proclaimed, and that very same day, they got him. I mean, that law hadn't even had to have time to have the sun go down on it once. They got it signed, they got it proclaimed, and that very day Daniel went to pray, that very day they showed up. They couldn't wait to get rid of Daniel. They assembled, they thronged before the king, and they remind the king, haven't you issued this decree? The king said to them, end of verse 12, the thing is true concerning the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. By the way, I do not recommend this method of setting principles and rules around your house. Sometimes we as adults, we think we're the Medes and the Persians, and we have laws that do not change. You know, we need to be a little flexible sometimes, don't we? I think we need firm boundaries with our kids. They need to know where they stand. They need to know where the edges are. But we also need to have some. You know, I think the point I'm trying to make here is even we, the all-wise parents, sometimes make mistakes. Sometimes we make rules that don't make sense after all. It's time to back off and say, well, that one wasn't so good. Let's try it this way. I remember a few times when I first came to pastor this church 11 years ago, I suggested some things to the board, some change in program or schedule or something, and we tried it, and it bombed. You know, I mean, it just didn't work. And I remember I was planning at the next board meeting to say, well, that idea didn't work. Let's back off and try something different. And I had some people coming to me trying to, they were going to try to lean on me a little bit and say, pastor, now, you know, this really hasn't worked out too well. Don't you think maybe we ought to consider doing, yeah, we should. It completely bombed. Let's do something different. I think the sign of strong people is not inflexibility, but it's willingness to admit when we've made mistakes and say, well, that didn't work. Let's try something else. Willingness to apologize, willingness to shift as things change. I was talking to one of the leaders in our, we call our early teen, our 13, 14-year-old, 7th and 8th grade group of kids for Sabbath school. And he said, you know, the last group of kids I had, they didn't like to sing, so I got tired of serenading them all by myself. He plays the guitar. But he said, the group I got now, they like to sing, so I think I'm going to get my guitar back out. You know, you got to shift with the plays, right? Got to be flexible. The Medes and Persians were anything but flexible. Make a rule, it cannot be changed. So they answered and said before the king, that Daniel, who's one of those captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petitions three times a day. Notice, Daniel, who has been a ruler in Babylon for 70 years, Daniel, who is now one of the top rulers in their kingdom, what do they call him? That prisoner of war, completely ignoring the fact that they looked in his government records and could not find anything but faithful service for years and years and years and years. They do the same thing Belshazzar does when he's drunk at the feast and the hand's written on the wall. He looks at Daniel and says, I've heard of you. Aren't you one of those prisoners we hauled over here from Judea? When Daniel had been ruling Babylon when he was a teenager, see? The disrespect, the attempt to denigrate somebody else just because they don't like him. That prisoner of war from Judea, he doesn't show due regard to you, O king, or the decree you signed, but he makes his petitions three times a day. And you know, the king about that time says, oh man, what a fool I have been. I have been suckered into this one big time. And he's in a dilemma because, as the king, the Medes and Persians have a rule. Their laws do not change once signed and sealed. When the king heard these words, he was greatly displeased. It doesn't say with them, it says with himself. Have you ever made a rule that you attempted to enforce and then discovered it backfired on you and you were displeased? He set his heart on Daniel to deliver him and labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. He called in all the best lawyers he could find to find some way to get around having to throw Daniel in the lion's den. It's kind of interesting how a sovereign ruler, a king, is still to some degree politically under the manipulation of his advisors. Now, I still wonder what would have happened if he'd have just said, hey, guys, the game's up. You were obviously trying to get this guy. You set me up. Go home, shut up, forget about it. We're not doing it. And when Cyrus gets here, he can throw me into den of lions if he wants to, but we're not throwing Daniel in. Now, I think that could have been done, but he probably would have risked his own life, his own power, position in doing it. So you have a man here who is undoubtedly a power person because, after all, he's at the top of the rulership of a great nation. And yet he's got some principles left. He wants to somehow get Daniel off. Then the men approached the king and said, do you realize the gall these guys had? They know the king's on to him. They know he knows exactly what they're up to. And they come back and say, you have to do it. Know, O king, that it's a law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king established may be changed. Get Daniel, do what you're supposed to do. Into the lions he goes. So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Now that's a period, not a question mark, right? The king speaks with bravado, but he's not feeling so good about it, is he? A stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. Does he really think somebody's going to climb down in the den of lions and get him out? Now, the next thing I wonder is Daniel, being in his late 80s, how did they get him in the den of lions? Because you know good and well, they don't like have a door at street level, open it up, hi, kiddies, and, you know, it's got to be up where they can't jump out. So in he goes. They drop him down into the lions. You'd think some guy in his 80s would at least break a hip, right? So I think a soft landing was the first thing God provided. Now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No musicians were brought before him, and his sleep went from him. So you know good and well his statement in verse 16, your God whom you serve continually, he will deliver you, was a hope against all hope statement, right? He didn't really believe it, but he sure hoped it. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve, what? Continually been able to deliver you from the lions. And the sweetest voice the king ever heard cried out, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. I like the way Daniel gets in that little kick. I was innocent before God, and I was innocent before you. The king was exceedingly glad for Daniel and commanded that they should take him up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him because he believed in his God. I thought I'd look at Scripture tonight for a few minutes and just kind of look at lions. Who's the first person in the Bible that we know took on a lion? Samson, right? Do we know anyone before Samson? I didn't think of anyone before Samson. Judges 14 verse 5 tells us that a lion came roaring out at Samson. Of course, Samson was Mr. Muscles, right? God gave him superhuman strength. And what'd he do? He just ripped that lion to shreds. God used a little different tactic with Daniel. He shut the lion's mouths instead of giving Daniel the strength to tear up the lions, right? It's kind of peaceful in that den overnight. It wasn't peaceful when Samson met the lion. Who's the next person we know faces a lion? David. Out watching his sheep, little David, the youngest of the brothers, the one they were sure wouldn't amount to much of anything. Little David, who when God sent Samuel down there to say, I want to make one of the sons of Jesse a king, and he went down through all the seven sons, I think it was, and God said, nope, not that one, nope, not that one, nope, 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 nope. And finally, Samuel says, have you got any more? Well, there's little David. He's out in the field with the sheep. Well, bring him in. And God says, that's him. And little David, we learn, while he was out feeding the sheep, was attacked by a bear, was attacked by a lion, and he grabbed the lion by the jaws. Now, that's a pretty brave guy, right? He grabbed the lion by the jaws and somehow disabled and killed the lion. It's pretty amazing. Little David. Proverbs 22:13. I like this one. The slothful man says, now what's a slothful person? An old English word is sluggard. What's a sluggard? What's a slothful? Lazy. Lethargic. The lazy man says, there's a lion outside, I'll be slain in the streets. It's just a proverb. Somebody is just trying to get out of work. Oh, if I go out there, they're going to eat me up. So I'm just going to stay in here safe and secure in my bed, curled up in a fetal position where I'm safe. What about facing lions? You know, Paul says something very interesting. 1 Corinthians 15:32. One of the ways that the Romans tried to get rid of Christians was they would put them in the arena and turn wild animals, lions and tigers and bears and things, loose on them and see who won. And it was usually the animals. But I find it interesting that Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:32, he says, if in the manner of men I have fought with beasts at Ephesus, what advantage is it to me? If the dead don't rise, let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Paul is talking about the resurrection. He's talking about eternal life. But he seems to intimate here that he very possibly had been thrown into the arena in Ephesus and fought with lions. And evidently, he was one of the few winners. We don't have very many stories out of ancient Rome of people fighting lions because they wouldn't give them any weapons, you know. They just stick women and children and men in there that were Christians or others they wanted to get rid of. And the people in the stands regaled as they sipped their sodas and ate their hot dogs to the wonderful sight of people being ripped into shreds and eaten by wild animals. Not my idea of a good time. 2 Timothy 4:17, now this one is clearly allegorical. We know Paul is being tried before Nero, and he was executed not too long after this. But he says, verse 16, at my first defense, no one stood with me, but all forsook me. May it not be charged against them, but the Lord stood with me and strengthened me so that the message might be preached fully through me and that all the Gentiles might hear, and I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion. Who's the lion he's talking about there? Emperor Nero. Yeah, he says, I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion. And in this case, he's talking about the Roman government under Nero, and Nero was a cruel, sick man. Now, he managed his first one, but later on we know that he, before he was let out of prison, he was found guilty, I guess, of being a Christian, and he was executed by beheading there in Rome. 1 Peter 5, verse 8 tells us that we need to be careful because the devil goes around. Be sober. Be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Now, let me ask you a question. Of all the Daniels who have been thrown to the lions, for how many has God shut the lion's mouth? Of all the tens of thousands of Christians who were thrown to the beasts in the Roman amphitheaters, for how many of those did God shut the lion's mouths? We know that thousands and thousands were killed. We know that. And crucified, and burned at the stake. Millions of people have died under the same circumstance or similar circumstances when Daniel here is spared. How do we deal with that? Does God have favorites? did he love Daniel more than he loved Huss or Jerome or those were men in the 13, 1400s that were burned at the stake for preaching scripture? How many, when you read Fox's Book of Martyrs, if you want a gory evening, read Fox's Book of Martyrs. The cruel and inhumane and awful ways that governments and church people have found to kill dissidents in the name of Christ are innumerable. And it seems like more people are allowed to die than have the lion's mouth shut. Every once in a while, God comes through as if to say, I am in control, I have the power, and I will care for you. But for most who are attacked lethally for their faith, God promises the resurrection. If you read the Church of Smyrna, Revelation chapter 2, he says, I know you're about to be killed. I am the resurrection and the life. Trust me, I'll bring you up. You see, as Christians, we have to take a longer view of things. Daniel knew that if he died, death is but a blink of sleep, and we rise at the coming of the Lord. So whether God, Paul, what does Paul say? Oh, where is it? I'm kind of shooting from the hip here on this one. I didn't have it in my notes, but it comes to mind. Paul says, I'm not going to find it here on the spur of the moment. It's in Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, or Colossians. Oh, here we go. I found it. Philippians chapter 1. For I know that this, he's in prison, by the way, for I know that this will turn out for my salvation through your prayers and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ according to my earnest expectation and hope that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but that with all boldness, as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ. For to me to live is Christ. To die is gain. If I live on in the flesh, this will mean fruit from my labor. Yet which shall I choose? I cannot tell. For I am hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. Being confident of this, I know I will remain and continue with you for your progress and joy in the faith, that your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ in my coming to you again. Paul says, I'm sitting here in jail and I hate it here. He says it would be better to be dead than to be here. And I'm kind of hard pressed because if I die, I know the next moment I'll be raised to be with the Lord. Right now in the position I'm in, I'm not sure which I'd choose if I had the choice. But I think God's going to spare my life because he still has work for me to do. And it's kind of an attitude that says, Lord, as long as you can use me, great. When you're done with me, and God's always done with us at some point, our ministry in life, our work in life is done, you can put me in your safe deposit box and raise me at the resurrection. We don't want to go. We're not morbid. But the point I'm trying to make again is this. We don't put our life in God's hands because he shuts the lion's mouths. We're thankful that he shut the lion's mouths a few times, and we know he has the power. We also know he rose from the grave, and he's the resurrection and the life. But we give our lives to him to live or to die, whether he shuts the lion's mouths or not. That's the commitment God looks for. Don't give your life to Jesus believing all the lion's mouths will be shut and you'll sail through this life. The devil goes around roaring at your heels. Bad things happen to good people. Christians die of disease and auto accidents, just like non-Christians. We serve a God who is able. And how he uses his ability is up to him, not us. And as long as he has use for us, he'll shut the lion's mouths and keep us alive. When he's ready to us to pass the baton on to the next person, he might give us a nice retirement for a few years, or he may let us go. For me to live is Christ. Daniel didn't go into the lion's den saying, God, I'll serve you if you save me. Daniel went into the lion's den probably expecting to be eaten. Just trusting God with his life. If this is the end, I know the next moment he'll raise me in the resurrection. I will stand in my lot. Look at the very last words of the book of Daniel, which very likely were given to Daniel at or before this time. The very last words in the book of Daniel, and we'll close with this for tonight. After giving Daniel these prophecies, he says, oh, by the way, no, this is given about 2 years after Daniel spent his night in the lion's den. Go your way, Daniel, till the end. You will rest, meaning you will die, and will arise to your inheritance at the end of the days. So whether you get eaten by the lions, or God lets you rip up the lions, or they just become nice fuzzy cats for the evening, for me to live is Christ. And when he lets me go to my rest, he promises he will raise me to my lot at the end of the days. That's our hope. Our hope isn't in the lion's mouths being shut. Our hope is that then, even if the lions eat us, we're not done. He's the resurrection and the life. That's our ultimate hope. We love the story, don't we? He shut the lion's mouth. And then we're frustrated when he lets him bite us. God is God. Let him be God. Give your life to him. He promises to raise you to your lot at the end of the days. That is the firm and final promise. In the meantime, let him deal with the lions.